What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, number 135, Tragedy, Death, Grief, and Healing. This week, we're going to be sharing my story. I have with me Bubba Wilson from Memorial Hermann. He's dealt with many people dealing with the situation, and my father-in-law, Pastor Mike Naren. As a pastor, he deals with lots of grief. We were also supposed to have Dr. Josh Yellen, who's had firsthand experience in doing CPR and actually losing some of those people, some of those athletes that, you know, they didn't make it. So he was called away due to a family responsibility, but maybe we'll get some input from him at some point later in the future. So I'm your host. I'm doing a special episode today, so my students won't even be here until after the show. So I'm going to be kind of bouncing around some, making sure everything's working and rolling. But if you want to join the conversation, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, using hashtag DSMB on Twitter. I'm not very likely to see that today, but normally it works that way. And then links to anything else are on our website. If you, you know, text or tweet me, then maybe I'll see it right here. But if you're logged in live, you can make comments in the comment area there in the login section. That's the most likely place for me to see it. All right, so I'm going to get right to it. Recently, we have experienced a loss, and today we'll be just discussing the grief process. And so I'm going to start off with the timeline of kind of what I know happened, and then we'll go from there. All right, so we have a kid that goes down on the track. The coach calls the athletic training room and checks on the athlete. So he says, you know, he's breathing, but he's out. So then coach decides something's not right. Before the athletic trainer gets there, coach begins to call 911. The other athletic trainer, Bill, arrives, and then he calls me because I'm in the weight room with my students and says, bring the AED. So I send a student to sprint out there with the AED, and then I'm getting there as fast as I can. When I get there, I hook up the AED. We let the AED do its job. It says shock, and so we do that, and we continue compressions and breath until EMS takes over. So then me and Bill go back to the training room. We kind of talk about what happened, and then go from there. I change clothes, go eat lunch, and head to the hospital. This whole time thinking, all right, well, I'm going to go in there and, you know, see he's doing all right. You know, maybe he's still unconscious or something like that, but I'm going to go to the hospital and just check on him and the family, and they're going to be like, hey, thanks for saving my son. Well, before I get to the hospital, as I'm like in the parking lot there at the hospital, I get a text saying that he had passed. So even at that point, like, it's still like, oh, okay. Because you know, I'm not really expecting it. It's not real at that point. So then I go in and, you know, a couple of the coaches are already there. They're the ones that had specifically worked with him that year. You know, they're there crying and praying and stuff like that. And some of the family members are there, but most of the family members are actually in the back in the room where he is. So, you know, I'm seeing these grown men cry. So my heart begins to break, but so I'm there for a while, for a couple hours, just sitting, kind of talking to family members, talking to our principal and our assistant principal that are there. So the hardest part, the part where my story is probably different, because just doing CPR and walking away, EMS does that stuff all the time. But seeing the family, the mom come out of the room, knowing that her son is gone, you know, one of the assistant principals asked me or introduced me to the mom, said, hey, this is Jeremy. He's one of our athletic trainers, was taking care of your son. And so then she said, she asked me what happened. And, you know, obviously she's crying. So like, I'm choked up. I start to tell her kind of what happened. I couldn't even finish telling her what happened. And she just says, thank you. So there was never a, why didn't you save my son or anything like that? She just said, thank you. So, you know, the nurse is talking to me saying, hey, you know, we don't have any idea what happened. We're going to do all this other stuff later, but, you know, we've done everything we could and nothing worked. So then, you know, she goes over and talks to the mom while I'm standing right there. And she asked her, where do you plan to bury your son? So, like, even now, that's the most difficult thing to say or to hear. I have children. I have kids. And to think about having to plan that or do that, it's very, very difficult. It's tough. So I've said this pretty much to everybody I've talked to. It's never for Bill, it's never a feeling of guilt, like we didn't do something we were supposed to do. We did everything we could. Well, we did it as fast as we possibly could. But it's my heart is broken for that family. The fact that they won't get to say, you know, goodbye or have a good day, or, you know, you're in trouble or something like that. Then, so they, you know, over the next, I think that happened, over the next 2 days, I was really busy. And I didn't really have a chance to kind of work through anything. I was really, really busy. So then Monday come to school and I was okay, but I was in a testing room, and then, so I was given a state test, and then I just happened to be down in the gym where they were talking with the athletes during the athletic period. And so at that point I began to lose it again. Just, you know, I go over and sit on the bench and I'm just crying, and, you know, one of the counselors comes over and talks to me, and it was just really tough. So that's more or less the timeline of that. So then we can continue to talk through, past experiences. So Bubba, you got any, tell me about some of your experiences.
I think the first thing that comes to mind really is I had a head coach that lost a child. And you kind of said it, the parents never expect to outlive their children. And I've got a daughter, as we've talked about before, that's getting ready to graduate high school and go to college. And she just had prom. And so, you know, the things that I think about concerning prom are totally different than the things they think about concerning prom. And I know we're a little bit off subject here, but it goes back to the parenting side. I don't expect to outlive my kid. And so I don't know that the coach knew what was going on with his child. It was a little different. There was some preparation and some readiness involved in the death of his kid. But again, you're never prepared. And the other, I think the one thing, as you were talking about, getting the text that he had passed away and it still hadn't hit you, one of the things we have to do on a regular basis is detach ourselves from the emotion of the event because of the injury. You know, we become very good, similar to detectives in the police force and EMTs and some doctors. We become very good at saying, you've just torn your ACL, you're done. They're all upset. You have to tell the coach. The coach is mad, and we have to kind of be that neutral party in the middle. And you were still in that mode early before the realization hit you, I think, of this is real. And then it changes everything. And I can't imagine. The other thing I think you said that matters to me is we did everything we could to the best of our ability as fast as we could. And so it's you always, I think, debrief it, as well you should. Mm-hmm. But, you know, no, the AED was there. The AED was functioning. It wasn't, you know, there wasn't a problem with that. It didn't advise another shock after the one. We continued CPR. You know, EMS got there, never quick enough. It's not like the movies. You know, it takes a while. But again, you've said we've done everything. We did everything that we could do. And sometimes we just don't win.
I think one of the things that impressed me several years ago was reading the top list of stress overall in a person's life. I think it was rated, I was trying to find the statistics, rated by the Institute for Psychology, and the top stressor was the loss of a child. In my experience, it's been quite a bit different when you lose, say, a mate, or you lose a grandparent, or even a sibling, which I've had the situation come up 2 years ago in losing a sister, the first of seven of us. But to lose a child, I have been with a lot of people, and the danger there, or the difficulty there, is they lose not only the relationship and the loved one, but they also lose a hope and a future.
Right. There's the potential is gone.
Exactly. That becomes a great stress there. And I think that when you mix that in, you see a real hopelessness that is a great danger in not only their life, but in friends of a young person also when they do. But I think that, you know, that stressor is phenomenal. I've watched a lot of, even losing a child that is older. I think in the movie Lord of the Rings, Denethor comes out of a stupor and he finds out his son has died, and he says your line that you said a while ago to Gandalf, the wizard. He said, Gandalf, nobody should have to bury their children. And I think that phrase has been stated to me through many funerals. Nobody should lose a child.
Right. And I think that not the suddenness, because unless it's an illness that you've been working through, it's always sudden. I think the one here is the unknown also makes it worse. The why. And, yeah. You know, and that hasn't been answered yet.
Right.
And so, you know, that's got to be tough, too. There's the car wreck. Okay, we know what happened. It's still sudden versus what was the cause of this.
Well, we search for something, I think, to hang our hat on.
Right, right.
As being the causative for it. And I think you're right. When it comes to something like this, I don't think the results are in at all on this one. And so there's not really an ability we have of saying, you know, this is why it happened, like you say.
Because what's one of the first questions we all would ask? Why?
Right.
What happened? What, you know, we don't know.
Yeah,
and that's even tough to say, too. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first question his mom asked me was what happened. So, you know, like I said, it was tough to say, but I couldn't finish telling her just because I don't know what happened. I don't have an answer. You know, I'm sorry. We did what should have, you know, what we trained for, what you think would have saved him, would have prevented this, and it didn't work.
Right.
So, we'll go back to kind of, like I said, Monday, I'm there, I'm crying, I end up going home and talking with Sarah, and it's an emotional roller coaster. So at times I feel like I'm fine, you know, but then at times, like, I would just kind of start weeping for no reason, you know, like unprompted. And it's not like I was telling somebody the story or anything like that. I just sadness. I mean, anytime, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm texting or typing up my story, or I'm telling somebody, then that's that first week or so, it's really tough. Anytime I'm telling it, I don't just get numb to it. And so it continues to be difficult, but again, I'm free from the guilt of knowing I don't feel like I did anything wrong, but it doesn't lessen the heartbreak of the family that I saw. So
I think you've hit on something that I worry about with friends of mine. We were talking before the program started about friends in the police force and different law enforcement, and sometimes I've been real concerned about them, that they would get jaded to the situation because they deal with it like ambulance and a lot of firefighters and stuff. But I think one of the things that Jeremy, you've hit on is, when you look around at the kids, even when a tragedy like this strikes a high school, kids that have never met that kid are moved emotionally because the loss of life is more dynamic than what we really admit at times. And I get concerned when you can compartmentalize that and sort of shove it to the side rather than allowing yourself to say, you know, this has moved me, and let that be an effect on you. It doesn't keep you from doing what is needed to be done at the crisis.
Right.
I mean, you guys are expert in that. I know when I go into a situation where there's a crisis, I go into a mode of taking care of what needs to be taken care of. But then afterwards, I mean, there are a few funerals. I've done tons of funerals, and there are a few that I have not somewhere along the line wept with that family just because I'm moved by their grief, even though I may not have known the person. So that's a good thing, and even though we can't explain why we might do it, you know, at different times, I think the thing is we ought to remain somewhat touchable to those experiences.
Right. Well, I know just in situations in the past that I've dealt with, when you're dealing with an injury that's significant, I couldn't tell you who was around me at the time. You know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be. Now, after the fact, you look around and go, where'd they come from? Why are you here? What's going on? The situation then changes. But in that moment.
Yeah, blood's gushing out.
Right.
I'm going through my list.
I'm doing my thing. And I think, you know, for this situation, for Jeremy, I'm feeling, my impression is that even after talking with Bill and leaving to go over there, you're still like, hey, we did our thing. The positive outcome is still there.
Right.
And even when the initial reality or the initial notice comes, the reality hasn't set in because it's like this, he was okay. He was alive. It was going to work. And then it's like, now the gears go shifting again.
Yeah. Well, you move out of taking care of the situation to dealing with the aftermath or the or the wake of that, you know. And it's totally an it's from shifting from practical application of your skills to a shifting of emotional. What I do with this
now to the to the reality of this now.
Yes, yes.
And so some of the things that you know, kind of you don't ever really expect to use, but Bubba, it was actually you that said in one of our previous conversations is that in a situation like this, the best thing that you've heard from people is that people would just check on them, just text and say, or email and say, hey, I was thinking about you. Like even this morning I get, you know, a tweet saying, hey, we're thinking and praying about you as you, you know, work through this today. And I mean, honestly, the biggest, every time somebody texted or emailed me, I would say, you know, I'm okay right now, or, you know, it's really tough right now, but please continue to check on me because of what you said, because I don't know. Every time I talk to a counselor, every time, you know, hey, if you need anything, even you said, you know, if you need anything, well, I don't know what I need. I don't know if I need anything. I've never been through this situation before. And so, you know, you're making yourself available, but it's easy for me to forget that you are available unless you continue to check on me. So if you text me next week, hey, how are you doing with this? Do you need anything? Like, well, actually, I need to talk, or, you know, this or that or whatever it is, but you're continuing to check on me. That's one thing I would really encourage people as they're having friends or people that they know going through a situation like this is to not just check once, say, hey, I'm thinking about you, but, you know, maybe set a reminder on your calendar every week, you know, just text that person at the same time and say, hey, I'm checking on you. Cause I might not want to talk about it. Like even right now I'm emotional. I don't necessarily want to talk about it with everybody, but to know that you're thinking about me, that you're caring about me, that does a lot. So,
well, let me interject in here because I didn't know where you were going as far as this, our progress through this, but you've hit on something really important, I think, and that is, number one, I'm glad you're doing the program because the more that you talk and speak this and tell this story, it's really a catharsis.
Right.
It really helps you deal with the matter. You verbalize what you're thinking, and your story will progress in its narrative to where you're inserting your observations at times. And what I wanted to take you back to was when you went to the hospital. A lot of people go to the hospital or go someplace to a crisis or a death, and they want to tell somebody, hey, I feel for you, I love you, and here's some good advice.
There is no good advice.
Exactly.
Right there. Yeah.
And my advice is shut up and just do what the mom did, ask questions. And I tell people to be nosy at a crisis. What happened? What were you doing? Tell me about it. Because telling it is a great catharsis. So a listener is the best thing you can be to a person who's gone through the stress that you went through, because I haven't been there. I haven't, you know, done breaths on a kid who's critical, but I've been somewhere else. And so I can say, hey, Jeremy, what happened here? And you can begin to verbalize. And as we verbalize, we process that emotion and that crisis.
Well, I have a good friend who's this fall, his wife died of cancer. And we were talking one day, and I said, I won't even try to begin to imagine what you're going through because I can't.
Right.
And we kept talking, and he said, you know, I've got other friends that have been through the same situation, but they're all different. So even they have an idea, but they don't know because their issue was different than my issue. So again, it goes to the, I'm sorry for your loss is about as good as it can get. I'm here if you need me. And that's what I learned through this. We did a program 10 years ago or so now that I'm interested in the after of all of this, not the, we did our emergency action plan. We had all this in place. All these things happened. We're supposed to have all that. I'm interested in what goes on after. How do you want me to respond to you when this happens? And everybody to a person said, just tell me you're thinking about me. I may not be able to talk to you today. I might not talk to you for a week, but I know you were there, you know, and they feel like, for lack of a better word to use, they're an outcast. They're a leper that this happened, and they're not. They, you know, who else stepped in some situations to do that other than those 3, 4, 2, 5, whatever number it is of people that were trying to save an individual's life?
Well,
you know?
I think Jeremy put it exactly right, though he didn't state it. The first place we go is, did I do something wrong? I mean, we immediately, if we are responding to a crisis, we say, did I do something wrong? And once you've settled that issue in your mind,
now we move forward.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, but it, the big question is, if I've not been through that, how do I move forward?
Right.
And when you go to somebody and you say, well, you've had your this one die in your family. I had my next door neighbor's husband died. You insult really the importance of that in their life by comparing it.
Right.
So really listening and saying, like you guys are saying, I'm there. How are you? You don't even have to say, what can I do? You can really just say, how are you? And that opens that door, you know, to their response.
Yeah. And even if the person survives, there's emotions that go with that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's just, it's sometimes you're just speechless, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's perfectly okay. You know, if there's just even silence today where you guys are just sitting and listening, it's okay. I mean, the counselor that came and sat with me, she just came and sat and said, hey, how are you doing? That kind of thing. And she just kind of slowly asked questions. And it wasn't ever like, I don't ever felt like she'd said, you know, hey, you're going to be okay, suck it up, or, you know, like, you did a great job, that kind of thing. She just, you know, well, what do you like to do? Or, you know, what do you do to take care of yourself? And, you know, do you have family? And just kind of asking me questions about me, just a chance to kind of talk, for me to talk and her to listen. It didn't necessarily have to be about the subject, but she just came and kind of sat with me. And then she's like, you know, if there's something else I can do, then let me know. And then she also said, have you ever dealt with a situation like this? And how do you prefer to deal with it? Do you like to talk? Do you like to be alone? Do you just like to go, you know, for a walk or something like that? I've never dealt with a situation before, but just being there, you know, asking, you know, would you like to talk, or, you know, just asking those simple questions. I think that was very important, because, you know, I'm not afraid. There was kids there. I'm not afraid that I was, or I'm not, I don't know. I guess I'm not afraid that I was sitting there crying while those kids were sitting there watching me. I think it's good for me to deal with it. And then it's also good for them to see a man dealing with it, dealing with emotions like that. Cause in the community that I'm in, you have to be macho, you know? And so for them to see a man that they know and that I hope they respect, that for me to be hurt, to be dealing with these emotions, I think it kind of frees them up. But like I said, dealing with a counselor, she did listen. She did ask. She did. She wasn't pushing. And so,
yeah, I think those questions prompt us to work through. And the more questions that are not leading you to say, here's what you need to do, that's really one of the worst things, unless it's something critical to their health or something. But most of the time, I stay away from telling a person something. I just say, like she did, what are you going to do? Do you have someone at home? Is somebody around you?
Right. I think, you know, and as we've all learned in school, the stages of grief, everybody deals with them differently.
Right.
And we may be stuck on one stage for a long time, and that's fine. That's how that individual deals with it. You know, there may be a time when somebody's got to kick them in the butt and say, you need to go talk to somebody.
That's true.
But at the same time, we've got to allow that process to run its course at least to a point.
Well, I think our fault, though, is we drop that ball somewhere between the after the first week and then, you know, a month down the road.
Right.
And we do something that I have done for years. We send a series of helps at intervals all the way up to a year later. And we do that, and we don't send the first one right away. Because most people, I know you guys probably have seen it, most people who are in crisis are not thinking,
yeah, leave me alone.
Yeah, and what you tell them, I found they don't remember sometimes, you know, 24 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's real important we remember that it's hard to give direction there. It's more important that they are voicing and you know, talking about what they've been through.
Jeremy, you were talking about the kids seeing you cry, and I think part of that is, you know, we as athletic trainers in a situation where every now and then we're going, no, you're going to go practice. You know, I'm sorry your finger hurts, but mm-hmm. you need to get out there. And sometimes it's good for them to understand, no, you really do care. Mm-hmm. Now, that's hard to convey, and you don't want that situation to be the one they see per se. But to say, no, this does matter. You know, we do matter to them. And you know, I think over time they understand what we try to do as well in other situations. But it is, in my opinion, good to see that, wow, they do have, they you know, they do have a soul. That does matter. We do matter to them because they don't think we do. You know, they think we're a heartless, cold individual that just wants to go win games, and that's not why we're there. You know, and it goes back to the other point of we detach ourselves from the emotion of it's fourth and goal and we're trying to win a game. I'm sorry, he can't go back in. You know, that's where we've been all our careers. And, you know, and the coaches don't see it and the kids don't see it sometimes. And then, unfortunately, there's a situation where they do see that side. You know, you don't want it to be that instance, but that's sometimes the only time they grasp it outside of their 4 years in high school, you know. Where then as they get older, something happens, I go, yeah, now I get it. You know, I understand why they were doing what they did. So,
one of the things that again, you don't understand it until you're in this situation, is there was everybody's trying to find something to blame. Everybody's trying to find a fault. And there was several rumors going around, and one of them was actually in dealing with the student that I had helping me. And there was people saying that he didn't get the AED out there fast enough. And, like, my first thought is just fury. Like, don't you dare put this on that kid. He's a high school kid that he was following my instructions. Don't you dare put that on him. Like I told Sarah, I was like, I might lose my job for punching a kid in the face if I heard him say that. And I'm not sure if I was joking or not. I really don't think I was, because don't you dare put them on there. And then, you know, I was talking to one of the coaches, and he's like, you know, they're hurting and they don't know what to do with emotions. They don't know what to do with emotions in general,
right,
as a teenager. And then when they're such, they witness a tragedy, they witness their friend fall down and die, they really don't know what to do. So they're just trying to blame somebody, trying to make sense of, and that's the only thing that they know how to do. And so it's really not that they're wanting to attack that person, but they're trying to make sense. They're trying to find a reason. And that's the easiest thing for them to grasp onto. And I think that's really good to help ease the situation. Cause I mean, I was angry. I was very angry. So
how long do you know? And we've talked about it. We've talked about a bunch. And so this isn't burned into my memory. From when EMS was called to when they got there, how long was that?
I don't know. I never looked at a clock. I got,
You're in your zone.
Yeah, they were called before I was. I think they were called before I was to bring the AED. Probably about the same time. So, you know, I just answered the phone. Okay, got it. Boom, go in. Never looked at the clock until I was probably walking back into the training room after the whole thing.
It felt like forever, and it felt like 2 seconds all at the same time.
Yeah, because I mean, there was so much going on. I was, like I said, I was the one that attached the AED provided the shock, and then I continued to give rescue breaths the entire time while several different people switched out with the compressions. And so while I'm there giving breaths, I'm also saying, hey, you know, who's going to be riding with this kid to the hospital because EMS is arriving? Who's over there telling the ambulance where to come? Who's opening up the gates? You know, while I'm doing this, I'm also kind of, you know, doing the things that I've been trained to do. So, you know, I never stopped to think or to look, because we're just constantly going. And then once EMS takes over, you're still just standing there waiting for something to happen, waiting for him to take that breath on his own. So,
right.
Well, I think, you know, I just talked about not comparing with somebody else's grief, but since we're not talking about grief, I want to make a comparison. I've been in the hospital with tons of people who have died, and that principle of looking for blame is universal.
Right.
And the problem is we can't accept, because it's a life, we cannot accept that life ends a lot of times.
Just happens.
It does.
Yeah.
And even though there is medical malpractice at times, I've stood with families whose the death of their 90-plus, almost 100-year-old person, and they're questioning, did they do this procedure or something right? And it's our natural tendency to look for somebody to blame. Mm-hmm. And it's a tragedy when you have a kid like you're talking about, Jeremy, that makes this effort with all his heart, I'm sure, to get this unit out there. And then someone imagines, and that's what a lot of times it is, they imagine that this must have happened since they didn't live.
Right.
And we tend to do that. We tend to gravitate, like we've talked all along. You know, there's something to blame. And, you know, we may not even ever really know. I mean, the autopsy, I'm sure, will show that's not correct. The autopsy will show, as best we can ascertain, what occurred. But we just tend to look for blame.
Right. Well, I know when I came by on Monday, and Jeremy wasn't here, but Bill was. And when I was talking to Bill, the grief counselors came through and were talking to him and then saying they were going to do this, get all the kids during the period to talk to them. And one of the things they said that was the reason why they were getting all the kids together, which I thought, you know, God bless you for doing this, was there's a lot of rumors and we need to quash them.
Yeah.
And I thought, thank you, as opposed to letting them run to say, you know, they basically said, we're going to go tell them we do not know and that there is no fault right now, you know, and so please stop.
But
and I liked that the fact that they were going to say, we don't know, you know.
But, you know, the lack of trust, without getting anything societal, the lack of trust in our society for authority causes them to doubt what the school will say to begin with. And we just tend even beyond assurance. I mean, I've had people have the autopsy of a loved one and then question whether that was, you know, the truth. We find it hard to accept death.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know, without blame in some way.
Right. Yeah. And that's never going to change.
You know, no, that's true. You just have to deal in the wake of that. You're right.
Right. And then the other thing is, you know, all coaches and sponsors have to be CPR and AED certified, trained. And so I think now, you know, they always, not all of them, but there's a bunch of, it's a laissez-faire attitude towards, well, we have the athletic trainers. Well, my argument is we're never on your bus. You know, I'm not always on that field.
Right.
Or wherever it is, and so now, you want a positive to come out of a tragedy. You really do, and I think that to me is the positive to come out of it. To say, I'm going to take this a little more seriously when they're teaching us now, you know. And now you've got a group of those that have gone through it that have said, nah, yeah, it's different than what we imagined on that mannequin, and you know, and so now, I know we taught a class last week, and they were very, they were very attentive with what we were trying to teach them. There was a lot of interaction and questions where normally like, let's just get this over with. So, you know, that's one of the positives that can come out of this tragedy is, yeah, it has now hit home. It's not the video game anymore.
You know, you see that on the news, but that brings me to a question that I haven't asked, and I'm wondering, when is the how long ago has it been since Pasadena School District has lost a student to something like this? Is that in even memory that you guys know?
I'm sure if we did some research, we could find out, but I mean, I know there was...
The last student loss was the car wreck a couple of years ago.
No, I'm talking about one like this on the field. I'm not remembering it.
I can tell you when, not when. It was at Dobie.
Okay.
Ooh.
It was before I worked here.
Over 10 years ago, I would think.
Okay. See, I could not, in my mind, remember. In my mind, my memory of Pasadena School District goes way back, and I couldn't remember one. So I think it is critical that, you know, not only reemphasizing what you're talking about, being certified on these, but also kind of prompting everybody, hey, prepare, because this is the aftermath. This is the wake of it.
Right.
Let me go back, because actually I went to Dobie High School, and we had a student die. I opened the door and pushed the cart in that they were wheeling the kid in to the training rooms and where they began performing CPR. I remember seeing the kid's eyes were gray. They were like rolled back in his head. But I didn't know the kid. I didn't, you know, I was a high school kid. Didn't go to the hospital. I didn't provide direct care. So I wasn't attached to that. I've had kids, like you said, you know, they die at home on a car, you know, a car accident or whatever. And those things, they hurt a little bit, but I wasn't there. I wasn't providing care. I didn't go to the hospital and see the heartbreak of the, you know, I didn't go to the funeral and those kind of things. And so kind of what you were saying earlier, comparing, you know, saying, yes, it's just not the same.
Right.
So those losses are still losses, but I've never experienced it to this degree to where I was firsthand involved. Up to this point, I've been certified in CPR since I was like either 14 or 15, whenever I started high school, and I've never once used it. So here I am, 34 years old, using CPR for the first time and being directly involved. I don't understand anybody else's but my situation, but I think some of the people that were involved are less attached because they weren't there at the hospital. They didn't see the aftermath.
Right.
They didn't talk to the family like I did. And that's a huge reason why my heart is so broken, because I've talked to the mom. She asked me what happened. You know, I was able to give her a hug and, you know, hug all the other people around. And again, at the at the funeral, the funeral was, it was really awesome to be there because obviously the funeral provides some closure to the event. But seeing all the seats were packed, there was people lined up around the whole edges, you know, standing up in the aisles. There's people in the front waiting area, people in the crammed in the back. There was even a ton of people that couldn't even, they were waiting in the little outside waiting area. I think he ended up saying that there was going to be like over 100 cars in the processional to the gravesite. That's a lot of people. And like, again, you know, I was crying there too, just cause you know, I talked to the mom again and just said, I'm so sorry for your loss. And, but then you get to hear just some of the stories or some of the messages. And, for me as a Christian, I found out then that I'm not 100% sure because I never asked him personally, but I'm pretty sure that he had accepted Christ and was about to be baptized, and it doesn't lessen the pain. It just changes it for me, knowing that he isn't, that it's not the end for him, for his family, knowing that, because that was important to his family as well. His grandpa was a pastor, and I think he was the one that was supposed to be baptizing him in a couple of weeks. But for the family to know that then, and to see those 200-300 people just kind of streaming through as the end of the funeral, just the closure and that brought, just being there at the funeral, again, it was emotional, but I think it was really good. It was good for me, and I think it was really good for the family to see. And you know, there was a lot of kids there, and again, I don't want to do this to be an example, but I'm glad that the kids were able to see me there, or that I was able to see them and talk to them and check on some of them the next few days. So,
you know, you bring up several issues there that have been something I've really thought through for years and years. Funerals are strange. A lot of people say, I don't want a funeral when I die. But the problem is, the funeral is not for you. You're gone and you won't know it. But the funeral is for closure and for people who are here, mm-hmm. to make a statement in some way and connect. We have a tremendous desire to connect emotionally with other humans. And one of the problems is, in our society today, death is antiseptic. Nobody dies at home anymore.
Right.
We die in a hospital.
Right.
The kids can't come into the room sometimes if there are children. Mm-hmm. And we die almost as, and we long, I think humanly, we long for that connection. And we wonder, because before this the last two generations, in America, we grew up on a farm.
Right.
We saw cows die and born, and dogs die and born, and all of this. And so the natural ebb and flow of life is not real to some of us
right.
now.
Well, and you had births and deaths at home and burials
yes.
on the farm. And
yes.
Right. And I think that's, but you just talked about not wanting the funeral. Like, my mother doesn't want one, but she wants a party.
Right.
Truly.
Okay.
After, you know, but what is it you see at every, it's a celebration of that life. Mm-hmm. And that's what you had that day. And that is another catharsis in the whole process of, you know, I've got another good friend that I've known since college, whose father died of a brain tumor. And I went up for the funeral for that. And it's very emotional. I never knew he was in the airborne. His dad was in the airborne, and that the whole color guard was very emotional when that happened. But what do? If you get the opportunity, we were at the viewing, we were talking, cutting up, laughing, telling stories. Mm-hmm. And as my friend said, I needed that. You know, you got to mm-hmm. get away from the grief a little bit and celebrate the life of who that person was.
Well, the truth is, the reason we're grieving is we missed that life.
Right. We're missing more opportunities.
Exactly. And,
yes.
and the things we remember, we're mm-hmm. not going to have those anymore. But I think, you know, Jeremy, you hit on with the knowledge of his faith. I think the important thing is, in life, God's word tells us that that he has put eternity in the hearts of men. And so we sense that there's something beyond this. I respect Dr. Stephen Hawking tremendously, one of the most brilliant minds around. But he said something one time that I totally disagree with. He said, we as a human are like a computer, and when we run down, then we are no better than tossing out like a computer that is outdated and won't run anymore. And so he denies that there's anything after this. And I think one of the reasons kids will go to a funeral, even though they don't know that kid, is I think personally they're really
craving a connection to life, and they go and they're moved, even though they don't know the kid, they're moved by the love for that person by other humans. And we crave that, I think, and we crave knowing what's the resolution. If death is it, hey, this is pretty much a bummer, you know, because I know 120 is pushing it these days. So there's got to be something past that is what most people, everybody I talk to, whether they've ever been in my church or any other church, they're still asking the question, okay, where is my loved one, you know, after this?
Right. Well, and I think you hit on something too, talking about the youth and craving that, you know, going to that funeral. Well, they're so disenchanted and disenfranchised right now that nobody cares. Well, then they're seeing this outpouring of love. No, they really
want a
do.
Piece of that.
Right. They really, again, seeing you, they really do care. It does matter to them. Maybe we do matter to them. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, that, as I've said before to some friends, at my age now, you know, it used to be we got out of college and went to our friends' weddings and then the birth of their children. Now we're going to the funerals. Those are our new family reunions. You know, that's the only time we get together. But there is still that outpouring of love shown, and some of those are getting it to say, you know, again, the one with my friend's dad, that's where we all decided we've got to get together more often. And so every other year we get together and do something, the five of us from college. You know, and if it wasn't for that, we'd talk every now and then, but we wouldn't be as close as we are now, probably.
It's a crazy thing because funerals with the grief are often, as you say, a bringing together where not this group would ever come back together for anything but this. So
right.
It's a really crazy, I'm trying to think of the word, not oxymoron, but it's kind of a strange situation. I can't think of the word, but these kids are craving that. And so they come to get what they're missing in their own affirmation mm-hmm. by being there. And they're moved by the family and the other friends that did know this person,
yes.
You know, we play some get to know you games with the students, and I've asked, I think all of them, would you rather have nobody show up at your wedding or nobody show up at your funeral? And all of them say wedding. They would rather have people at their wedding than their funeral. They're like, I don't, you know, when I'm dead, I don't care. I don't care if anybody's there. I want people there at my wedding. Right. But I always say I would rather nobody show up at my wedding and people show up at my funeral. And they're like, why? I'm like, because at my funeral, if nobody shows up, my entire life was empty.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's nothing. Mm-hmm. I meant nothing to anybody if nobody shows up to my funeral. And I don't want my entire life to be meaningless or useless or to not have affected anybody in a positive way. Mm-hmm. And it's been a long time since I've been to a funeral. It took me a long time to realize that the funeral is not about me, mm-hmm. that it's about the family, about those other people that love them. And so going to that funeral, like I said, for the family to see that.
That show of support.
Yeah. I mean, truly, I don't know how long it took, but it took a long time for all of those people to funnel through. And I was outside well before all of the people in the back were out. And that was before even the benches were cleared out, to do their final goodbye to the body or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just went up and said goodbye to the mom and the family there. But just for them to see that, how important that he was to them, was, like I said, I would much rather nobody show up at my wedding, because then I still have time to change, still have time to affect people's lives. So, again, I think it's important to go to those things, if not for yourself, for closure, then to support those students and those athletes and those that family.
I think a poet said it well at one point. He said, men are like trees. They are best measured when they are laid down to rest. So when you cut off a tree and you measure it since it's laying down, a man is best measured by when he dies. And one of the good things is that often people are reminded of just how important this person is. And expressing that, we get back to how do you deal with this? Expressing that is so important. I have people say, I don't want to go to the hospital when somebody's sick. I want to remember them how they were. And I'm not real gentle with them. I look at them and I say, they're in the hospital. I could care less what you remember. Your job at this point is to do something for them. They're
right.
The hurting one.
Support them.
Yeah,
right.
And at the funeral, it's the same thing. You're not staying away from a funeral because you can't handle it. You ought to be there in support of that family. Mm-hmm. Like Jeremy said, it's for them and not for you. This is not about your grief. It's theirs.
it matters to them that you show up.
Very much.
You know, and I've I've heard that and been told that. Thank you for coming. It means a lot. And you sit back and go, and then you kind of think about going, no, I guess it does. You know, that show of support, again, that that person mattered to you. You know, that person matters to you, matters, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I've talked with a lot of families, and one of the strange things, you mentioned that, and one of the strange things that I've noticed is if they go to telling the story later, the funeral, of course, is you should have seen all the people there. But if they're at the hospital like you were, Jeremy, sometimes they'll tell me, they'll say, I couldn't count how many people were there. They may not know your face, but right. you being there was an affirmation of importance of their loved one.
Right.
So you were talking about support. One thing I don't think I mentioned is that I did receive, or I think I mentioned it, but, you know, I received a lot of texts and emails and, you know, people on Twitter. I didn't give any specifics then at the time on Twitter, but just saying, you know, I've had this situation happen. So, you know, people texting, tweeting, and emailing. And a big part of it was athletic trainers, so the people in the district or people that I've worked with, just saying, hey, you know, we're thinking about you guys, we're praying about you guys, or, you know, if there's anything we can do. So just reaching out, you know, you're talking about supporting the family, and definitely want to support the family and those people that are directly impacted. But the people that gave care, the people that are still hurting, you know, so any of the athletic trainers that listen, that you know somebody, I would definitely encourage you to reach out, because I don't know if I responded to everybody. I think I went back and tried to say exactly what I'd said, you know, thank you, I'm okay right now, please, you know, feel free to check back. But just knowing that, like, I think I talked to Bubba probably that, you know, the next couple of days afterwards, and I was like, you know, the one thing that I'm really seeing is that there's a good, I don't know if outpouring of support, but there's a lot of athletic trainers reaching out and just saying, you know, hey, I've never been in this situation. Hey, I've been in this situation, and it's tough. And, you know, like you were saying, just listening, not saying, well, here's what you need to do.
Right.
Because I felt like some of the people that were counseling were kind of like, all right, well, you know, do whatever you need to do. I don't know what I need to do.
Right.
But
you don't know what you need to do, but at the same time, you don't want somebody to tell you what you need to do. It's a catch 22.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's they were just kind of like, well, you know, I've been through a similar situation. Here's, you know, what I did. And, you know, I talked to Josh, he was supposed to be here, and he said, it doesn't ever get any easier. It doesn't. You know, you still have to deal with that kind of the rest of your life as you're talking about the CPR or the, you know, losing an athlete or the heartbreak. You know, you may be a little less, like, visibly emotional, but it's always going to be there with you. He said it doesn't get any easier. So it's just something that I'm going to be able to share. But, again, you know, Bubba, you were talking about wanting something good to come out of it. I know when I was teaching the class with you this week last week, I was able to say, hey, guys, you know, I am Jeremy, that, you know, we had this happen on my campus, and this is what I saw, you know. And so at that point, they're like, oh, okay. So it changes things. And so from now on, I'll never be able to say I've never been part of CPR. I've never done CPR, but I'll be able to say I have done it. And so for the next couple of years, it'll be fresh in people's memory, and they'll be able to say, you know, yeah, I will pay more attention. So maybe next year when I do that mass CPR training for the freshmen, I'll be able to bring up that story and just say, hey, this happened here. You know, this could be you while you're on this track, like, or this could be your teammate, and you could be the one to take care of them first. And so I think that there's definitely ways that can help us grow those events.
Right.
So.
When did you, let me ask a question, when did you guys in the district get the units?
The AEDs?
Yeah.
I think we've had AEDs in the district since I've been here.
Okay.
So, but we've gotten several more.
It became a state law. Don't hold me to this. I want to say in 07, maybe 09.
Okay.
That every school has to have at least one, and it has to be accessible within like 2 minutes.
Right. Okay.
So that's been out there for a while now.
Okay.
And then the CPR training has been even before that.
Oh yeah. It's been for a long time.
But I think the one thing is why I'm interested in part of this is not that the families don't matter, but the caregivers are lost in the shuffle. And that's why, yeah. You know, when I found out, at least just leave me a message. It matters. It's,
yeah.
You know, I'm going to use a bad analogy here, but you never want to do CPR and a policeman never wants to have to shoot their weapon.
Right.
You know, and I think they're similar in vain. Like, that's the worst case scenario for both instances. And I don't ever want to have to do it outside of teaching it, mm-hmm. you know. But I know if I did, there's a community that's going to come to my, you know, right. to my aid and say, right. here we are. You know, like just like those did for you and Bill. We're here for you.
Yep.
What do you need? You don't know what you need, but if you need it, let me know.
Well, one of the marks for you guys, and I can speak maybe on this because I'm not a trainer, but one of the great things that I've noticed, and I made the statement to somebody about this situation as I was telling them, I said, you know, if there was anybody that I would want at that scene handling this, Jeremy's the one. And the reason is you guys have gone over this and over this, and it's second nature, number one. And number two, you're able to do what is needed at the moment. And that defines a professional to me in what they do. And so when we think about that, we expect that, but then it shocks us sometimes for that to have to occur.
Right.
It's still the best thing we can do
right.
that we know of for that situation. And so I just want to say thanks to you guys and others that are trained in that and are committed to carrying that out in a precision that's our best hope. You know, we can't predict the outcome, but it's our best hope.
Firemen rush into a burning building when everybody else are running away, and it doesn't guarantee the building's going to survive.
That's exactly
the situation.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But right.
Yeah. That's a great analogy, I think. We go into these situations, and I do it in other areas, but you guys go into these, and you don't know whether that's going to work, but that is our best hope.
Right.
And we do it to the best we can.
So one of the guys I was talking to, Derek Cook, he said he had a situation similar when he was in college, and the policy was that if you were involved in like a traumatic event like that, that you had to take a week off. And so he's like, you know, I took a day off, but then I was kind of going crazy at home. Like I said, you know, keeping busy. But I'm just wondering, like, we haven't had time to take off. We've been involved in state testing. You know, we have spring football. So we haven't had time to just take off and really process. Now, we're not throughout the day, you know, we did get some breaks where they kind of shuffled us out of the testing and into the babysitting or, you know, helping with something else. But I'm just wondering what do you think would be the normal procedure for time off? Because every time I've talked to somebody, they're like, you know, if you need to take some days off, you need to take some time off, you know, you might want to take some time off, or if you need to, you know, not do this for a couple of things. And so, you know, this coming week, Bill and I are going to be switching out days because we can't just take off, right?
Right.
If I take off, then that's twice the work on him. If he takes off, that's twice the work on me. And if we're trying to work through this together in the same situation, so we're going to, you know, end up, we're going to alternate this week kind of who's off. But like in other situations, Bubba, what has your experience been?
They're all different. And some people want that time alone to process and do that and just say, you know what? I'm off for 3 days or 5 days, and some are like, no, I want to get back in the saddle and do what I do because that's my therapy. And there is no right answer and there's no wrong answer. I think the fact that it's offered is good because they're not saying you got to get back on the horse right now, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, hey, you do it how you need to do it. If you need to take off, we understand, and I think they should understand if you need to take off.
If you say
I need professional help, they need to say, got your back, you know, but let you go through it how you need to go through it, because there is no one way, as we've talked about a lot, and everybody's different, you know, and today you don't want to be off, next week you might, don't know.
I think that's a great observation, because we do all handle it differently, and I find a catharsis in doing something. I'm not a person who can retreat, because then my mind goes to really working something over and it becomes almost futile for me.
Right.
But other people are wired to where they need to process this, thinking it through. And some of those, I'm glad you said what you did a minute ago, because some of those need it a week or a month later. Mm-hmm. They find that stress becomes, I really need some time to kind of clear my mind, you know, maybe not even work through it, just clear my mind. It's kind of caused a backlog or a backup in my process. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. That may come later. I've known people who haven't dealt with grief till 6 months later.
Right.
And then all of a sudden they call me and they say, I'm having crying spells and I can't stop and stuff. So it becomes, it's individual. So
if you need to go sleep for 3 straight days, that's what your body tells you it wants.
Exactly.
And that's what you want to do. Go do it. If you want to go to the beach and watch the waves, you know, whatever it is, however you feel you need to handle it, I think there's no wrong answer.
All right, so on that same note, like, if, you know, how am I going to be able to identify in the next few weeks if I'm struggling with dealing with this, or if it's just something else, or if I'm just blaming this, if I'm just making this my scapegoat? Like, what are some things that I should be looking for?
I would say at that point, I would probably go, I need to talk to a professional. But I don't, obviously don't deal with that. He's our best answer man for that right now.
Well, I think that as with anything, you kind of do a triage of your thoughts and you say, okay, what's happening here? What's the primary thing? Am I stressed because of this? And Jeremy, you with your faith, prayer can help you to determine that. A lot of people think prayer is talking to God, but really prayer is a process of letting, when you talk to God, of processing where you are and talking things out. And so I think that you'll know by elimination, am I just totally stressed? And if that's the case, it may be that you need time because this has caused kind of a backlog or a backup in your ability to process. It's not necessarily that it's just always on your mind, but you're finding a difficult time processing normal problems or
everyday tasks.
Everyday task and things. That's a real indicator there's something definitely wrong. But if you're feeling stressed, a time away, a day off might just clear the air and let you just enjoy something and kind of unplug that that backup that this has caused psychologically and emotionally. But again, it's just a person, because some people are wired to be busy and work through something, and some, I mean, I like to pound a hammer or something if I'm stressed or something. But others, they want to go sit alone like you said, at the beach or in a lonely room and process. And sometimes I may want to do that too. So it really depends not just on the person, but the circumstance.
Well, to me, you said your thing is you want to pound a hammer. And I think where it would matter is you go pound that hammer and you don't feel better.
Well, that's
now,
true.
Now that's okay. I've got to do something.
Yes. Yes.
If that release for you is no longer the release.
I think that's a great point. If you can't get, and I was headed towards that, but thanks. If you can't get normal release from something, then there's probably an indication that there's something that needs to be dealt with in a different way. It could be that you take a few days off, or it could be that you talk some more with someone. But I think talking it out as you go consistently, the only time you need to worry about whether you're telling the story too much is if you're telling it every day and you're just telling it over and over.
Interjecting it into every conversation, no matter
exactly,
what it is. Yeah.
Exactly. Other than that, I'd tell the story over and over, because I think I've always felt that's a great catharsis, getting through something.
I guess there would be a difference in, hey, how you doing? Tell me about this, versus you're at the dinner table and go, well, 2 weeks ago I did this, and you're bringing it up in every situation.
Yes, yes. If it becomes kind of a filter to what you're saying, then there may be a cause for concern.
So another thing I have is I wasn't directly responsible for what he was doing at that time, what the student was doing. So how do I help those coaches that were directly responsible? Their actions, their instructions were what caused, you know what I'm saying? Like, even if they know that what they did, and I from talking to them, I believe that they feel confident. They weren't pushing them too hard. They weren't calling them a sissy for not running. You know, they're all right, you know, kind of run these at your own pace. So they feel confident in what they did was not the cause or the reason. But I don't believe that you can possibly separate the guilt of I was responsible for him at that time.
I directed them that ultimately. Yeah. I think from my standpoint, I would have to be telling them, was what you wanted them to do out of the norm?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the kid was on the basketball court practicing, is that out of the norm of your what's going? No, it's not. Is conditioning out of the norm? No, it's not. You know, if you had them doing something crazy, now was it like crazy, fun, different, entertaining versus over the top training are two different things. And I think that's where it would be for me. Was this normal to go out there and do this? Did y'all do this periodically, regularly? Then it's a tragedy. It's unfortunate. But if it was something beyond that, you might want to rethink that. You know,
when I heard the news, I immediately looked at the weather, and I said, this is a nice day. There was no exterior pressure. And then Jeremy, one of the first things you said to me was the coaches weren't, you know, stressing them or behind them saying, you know, you're a chicken or you're a wimp because you're not running fast enough or something. Right. And they, you know, never belittling anybody because they're not the first down the finish. But I did a thought process in my mind, and I thought, well, there's nothing exterior or impact on him from a coach or anything.
Well, that's what I did the same thing because I heard and I went, oh, that's a nice day out. And and running on the track is not out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
You know, so you're like, you know, from there. You know, it's not like they were, you know, I don't know what to bring up to use as something crazy, but, you know, it'll jump out at some point. But it's like, I did the same, again, the same thing. Like, yeah, okay, that's a normal day.
But that's what we were talking about earlier, that we are always searching for something to blame.
Right.
We want to hang blame on something. And, you know, unless we're missing something, you can't see it on the, you know, from just looking at it.
Right. It's not like they violated the weather, you know, the lightning policy or whatever while they were out there and it's striking all around. Go, oh, let's get three more in and we'll go in. That's, you know, that's totally different than we need to go get some running in or we need to go get some lifting in or whatever it is.
Yeah. And so how do I bring up that topic to say, how are you guys doing with this without creating it? Because, I mean, do I just say, how are you guys doing? Or, you know, because I don't want to say, hey, how are you doing with the whole guilt of knowing that you're responsible for his actions without saying, because I don't want to create that.
Right. You don't want to put the wall up. I think if I was the coach, I would like somebody to say, hey, let's say I was there with you. If you need to talk, we can talk about it. We both experienced it. And I think there comes a little bit of kindred spirit with that, similar to soldiers, you know, when they say, I'll talk to my buddies about combat that were there, but you can't understand.
Well, I think that's good. And I think also, even though we've talked a lot about questions, I think bold statements sometimes, if you're comrade in arms in a situation, as you just said, I think bold statements are good. And I wouldn't have a problem walking up to one of the coaches and saying, look, I just want you to know that if you're doubting yourself, I want you to know that I firmly believe that you do a great job and I don't see anything that you need to be worried about. So if you are, how about let's talk?
Yeah, I got your back.
Yeah, I got your back. Let's talk. But I think an affirmative statement sometimes in this case is as good as, how are you doing and can I help or something. Sometimes those are a bit vague. And sometimes an affirmation of saying, hey, you coach, you do a good job. I don't want you doubting yourself, you know, and just make it that simple, you know, is a positive thing.
One of the things you guys were just saying was something else that we were also discussing is I don't really, really want to talk about it to somebody who wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, you know, the other athletic trainers, the nurse or the administration or the police officers that were there, I don't, or the, you know, the EMS, the, you know, I text the EMS guy and, you know, just ask him some questions. And with those people that were there, I feel really comfortable talking about it. But with somebody that I don't have a close relationship with already that wasn't there in the situation, I don't really want to talk to you. I mean, thank you for your concern, but I don't really want to talk to you.
Right.
You know, it's not that I don't want to talk. I don't know you that well. I'm not that close to you. You weren't there. I don't want to talk to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Acknowledgement of that concern is good and let it go. Those people are probably some of those are well-meaning. Some of those are just nosy and want something to talk about. And they want to be in the mix. They want to feel as though I talked to Jeremy, you know, about this or something.
I know all about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you just have to pick and choose there, just acknowledge, you know, and then go on. But I would just encourage you to just acknowledge it and let it go.
So thank you for the concern.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
So what if you have a pushy counselor that, you know, that keeps coming, like somebody just, hey, you know, let's talk about it. Hey, we need to talk about it. Hey, I want you to come sit and talk to me about this event.
They need to see a counselor.
I think my response initially would be polite, and then it wouldn't be so much, but it'd be when I'm ready or if I feel the need, I will.
Yeah.
You know, and you could say I may be ready to talk to somebody else or not, you, no offense, but you know, I'll work through this on my own terms.
Yeah, or, you know, I'm talking to somebody right now. I've got some emotional and spiritual and help, and just kind of leave it at that and see if they'll go away. If they don't, you may have to say something a little more direct.
All right. I think it's more or less all the stuff that I wanted to cover, at least that I could think of now. And again, I definitely want to say, like, it's tough, especially anytime I talk about, you know, what the mom asked me or when what the nurse said to the mom. But being there to support the family is important and is something that I'm just learning. But also allowing other people to grieve with me just by saying, hey, I'm here for you. Hey, you know, if you need to talk, hey, if you need anything, I know you don't know what that anything is, but if you need something, then let me know and we can figure it out.
I think the one thing, though, to tell you is if it wasn't tough, I'd be worried about you.
I agree.
You know?
Yeah. And I don't know how tough it would have been had I not gone to the hospital.
Right.
I don't know. I can't say.
Well, we can't go back either and find out.
No, but I'm gonna be bold enough to say that I think I know. Because I've watched these scenarios play out, and I'm going to tell you that you're probably, you would probably be looking at significantly less connection, and we probably wouldn't even have this program today because, again, this antiseptic society we have, we deal with what we need to. I was there, and yeah, you guys need to learn CPR and all this. You can do all of that, but your emotional connection is centered completely on your touch with that mom. And that ignited your emotional connection there. And so I would remind you that I know you, Jeremy, and I have full confidence that this is not going to be just the impact it is with Jeremy. You're still processing that. But I'm going to tell you, you need to transfer that to the kids and others, you know, from here on out that you come in contact with. And that's going to be the benefit to you and others is when you transfer that, not just process it.
Anything else?
No, he pretty much hit it on the head with that one.
Anything else? All right. Well, again, like I said, this is really just my story, how I'm dealing with it. Maybe we'll revisit it in a month or so and just see and get some input from Yellen. I don't know. We'll see. But, you know, right now, today, I'm doing okay. Like I said, if I'd still talk about those certain things, and it's pretty tough, but I don't know. I don't want to stay on this issue when I don't need to, but I also don't want to jump past it when I need to stay on it. And so it's one of those things where I don't know what to do. And I appreciate you guys for coming, listening, talking, you know, sharing with me and with anybody that listens to this now or at some point in the future. So, again, as I'm going to mention in each of the episodes here, School Health is just signed a deal to be a sponsor for the podcast, just so that you guys that are listening can get some cool stuff. So they're going to give away some gift certificates or some prizes each month, and then we're going to talk to one of their representatives and find out what's new and beneficial in the sports medicine product world. So it'll be pretty cool. It'll be a good way for you guys to interact and get some free stuff, hopefully. GHETS continues to make the CU opportunities available. Bubba Wilson, right here sitting in front of me, is one that gave me this cool banner in the backdrop that has been well involved with everything we do, but he's also, you know, made an important effort to reach out as we're dealing with this situation that we just talked about today. So I thank you for the friendship that we've created. Bubba, appreciate that.
My pleasure.
If you want to check out our website, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, almost every single Wednesday you can watch live on our website. You can join the conversation by joining in there. I think I saw Matt Babisek is logged in. I think there's somebody else logged in, but I can't tell who it is. So shout out to Matt for listening live to my story of kind of what went down. So on Twitter, that's where you're going to find me the most often, PHS Sports Med. But that's about it. So for Jeremy, for Bubba, for Mike, that's a wrap.
But yeah, just to watch them look at all that and go, you know, wow. But he still travels. He'll travel somewhere and, you know, mark the street and get involved in all of that. And he said a lot of times the car's gone, it's put in storage, but he'll come back and photograph and look at their markings. things start going and looking at the car and go, it can't happen with this damage here. How are they saying this? You know, and then here they go, you know.
Well, you do a triage like that with injury.
Right.
You know, and my friend who was a ranger did a lot of murder. And
who was your friend that was a ranger?
Ronnie Brownlow.
Okay, I knew McClintock.
Okay. Brownlow was a ranger for years. He's a sheriff now up in Athens.
Okay.
But he was one of the top guards for the governors for a long time. But he worked on, do you remember Henry Lee Lucas?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he worked on that case and was one of the arresting officers and did the questioning of Lucas.
Okay.
It's actually streaming live right now.
We'll discuss that one after the fact. I got an I think that was the last one, but I got an interesting story about the guy that how he became a ranger. It was pretty fascinating.
Ah, cool.
You don't need them. It's only in case you just want to hear how you sound, but
you'll want them.
Yeah. Yeah, I use it when I record. Does it matter which one on here, Jeremy?
What do you mean?
Are all these live?
Yeah, they're all.
Okay,
yeah.
I hear it. Thanks.
Yeah. Are you guys ready? Okay, so I'm not sure if you can see this. It says don't say the name or the date.
Okay.
All right, here we go in 3, 2, 1.